Chapter 11. Emancipation. How American Nationalism Can Save the Country. Go down, Moses, way down in Egypt land, and tell old Pharaoh, let my people go. Negro Spiritual. On November 19, 1863, Abraham Lincoln stood at the battlefield of Gettysburg and delivered some brief, telling remarks. Without making any specific reference to the Battle of Gettysburg, and without once mentioning the word America, he said that the Civil War was a test of whether a nation dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal can long endure. Lincoln said it was for us the living to continue the unfinished work of the war dead, to ensure that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that the government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. For all their familiarity, these words are also strange. Clearly, Lincoln was saying that in the Civil War, America's very survival was at stake. But why? Wouldn't America still exist whichever side won the war? Let's say that Lincoln negotiated a settlement with the Confederacy, in which the Missouri Compromise, the law that had kept the peace from 1820 to 1860, was restored in an expanded form so that slavery would be permanently allowed south of the Mason-Dixon line, which would now be extended all the way to the Pacific. This is not imaginary or counterfactual history. Such a solution was proposed and seriously debated. The Crittenden proposal was named after the man who devised it, Kentucky Senator John Crittenden. Historians agree that it was the only way the Civil War could have been averted. Some Republicans, terrified of the prospect of war, warmed to a seemingly equitable division of territory that would have prevented it. Had Abraham Lincoln gotten behind the Crittenden proposal, it would most likely have passed, and there would have been no Civil War. Yet Lincoln worked behind the scenes to defeat it. Stand firm, he told his fellow Republicans. Compromise on the very core of what the Republicans campaigned for, he said, would mean all our labor is lost and sooner or later must be done over. Admittedly, the pressure to give in seemed irresistible. That was why Republicans had to be tough. The tug has to come, and better now than at any time hereafter. We must admit, in taking his stand against Crittenden and other compromise measures, Lincoln, notwithstanding his seeming attributions of the war to unavoidable circumstances, and the war came, nevertheless played a decisive role in its tragic and bloody occurrence. If Lincoln's stance here were self-serving or reckless, he could be said to have plunged the nation into an unnecessary cataclysm, and, far from being America's greatest president, he would have to be considered the worst. No defender of Lincoln can agree with such an assessment. So why did Lincoln reject the Crittenden Compromise? For him, the issue was starkly simple and yet unutterably profound. He had won a free election, and now the Democratic Party was attempting to reverse the outcome of that election. He had secured an electoral mandate for halting the spread of slavery, and now the Democrats, both in the North and the South, sought to force him to bargain away his mandate. The Democratic South had not only threatened to break up the country, but was in the process of breaking it up, putting Lincoln in the position of having to relinquish his Republican principles in order to discourage this process. Lincoln said he would not and could not do it. Why not? Because, Lincoln argued, his electoral mandate was not his to give up. True, he and his fellow Republicans had campaigned on the platform of restricting the spread of slavery. Once the American people, speaking through an electoral majority, approved that mandate, Lincoln insisted that it no longer belonged to him, it now belonged to them. No popular government can long survive a marked precedent that those who carry an election can only save the government from immediate destruction by giving up the main point upon which the people gave the election. For Lincoln, to bargain away his mandate would be to give up on the meaning of democracy. Only the people themselves could give up what they alone possessed. The people themselves, and not their servants, can safely reverse their own deliberate decision. Therefore, Lincoln said, "I will suffer death before I will consent or advise my friends to consent to any concession or compromise which looks like buying the privilege of taking possession of the government to which we have a constitutional right. I should regard any concession in the face of menace as the destruction of the government itself and a consent on all hands that our system shall be brought down to a level with the existing disorganized state of affairs in Mexico." And again, "We have just carried an election on principles fairly stated to the people. Now we are told in advance the government shall be broken up unless we surrender to those we have beaten before we take the offices. If we surrender, it is the end of us and of the government. They will repeat the experiment upon us ad libitum. A year will not pass till we shall have to take Cuba as a condition upon which they will stay in the Union." Now, Lincoln acknowledged that while majorities have a right to rule, the power of even elected majorities is strictly limited by what the Constitution authorizes. Majorities do not have unlimited power. Moreover, they are obliged to respect minority rights no less than their own. Even elected majorities have no warrant to trample on the constitutionally specified rights of minorities. Lincoln conceded that if he had violated the constitutional rights of any individual or group, such as its right to free speech or freedom of religion or to freely assemble, then those individuals or groups would be justified in leaving the Union. "Think, if you can," Lincoln said on March 4, 1861, "of a single instance in which a plainly written provision of the Constitution has been denied." Then Lincoln added, "Such is not our case." Lincoln had violated no constitutional rights, let alone vital ones. Therefore, Lincoln said, "The election and its aftermath presents to the whole family of man the question whether a constitutional republic or a democracy, a government of the people by the same people, can or cannot maintain its territorial integrity against its own domestic foes." In his July 4, 1861 message to Congress, Lincoln added, "Our popular government has been called an experiment. Two points in it our people have already settled, the successful establishing and the successful administering of it. One still remains, its successful maintenance against a formidable internal attempt to overthrow it." Lincoln insisted, "We must settle this question now, whether in a free government the minority have the right to break up the government whenever they choose. Because, if we fail, it will go far to prove the incapability of the people to govern themselves." It was his task and the task of all patriots, Lincoln concluded, to demonstrate to the world that those who can fairly carry an election can also suppress a rebellion, that ballots are the rightful and peaceful successors of bullets, and that when ballots have been fairly and constitutionally decided, there can be no successful appeal back to bullets, that there can be no successful appeal except to ballots themselves at succeeding elections. So now we can see why Lincoln went to war. He went to war to save not just the nation, but a certain type of nation. For Lincoln, America would not be America once the proposition that all men are created equal and the whole ensemble of constitutional principles that flow from it was given up. Lincoln refused to submit to an America defined by the principles of the slave plantation, principles whose realization Lincoln regarded as tantamount to the death of the nation. Even more, in Lincoln's words, it would practically put an end to free government upon the earth. But why did the Democratic South start the war? Even a scholar as astute as Harry Jaffa argues that the planter class made a colossal strategic mistake. These people had slavery in the South. Lincoln had pledged not to interfere with it there. Yet after the war, slavery was permanently abolished throughout the country. One might suspect, Jaffa writes, that the Southern secessionists were financed by abolitionism as they catapulted slavery toward its destruction. I believe, however, that these Democratic planters were not so dumb. They realized what Lincoln's election signified, that the balance of power had tipped against them. Slavery was now indeed, as Lincoln promised, on its way to ultimate extinction. The Southern Democrats went to war, but they knew that they could count on the Northern Democrats to undermine Lincoln from within Union ranks. If they waited longer, their political position was likely to deteriorate further. Yes, they might lose the war and lose it all, but they were going to lose it all in any event. Thus, their best time to strike was now. A similar situation. I think the perceptive reader will know full well why I am recounting this history. Notwithstanding all the Solomonic pronouncements about how history does not repeat itself, we are in a very similar situation today with Trump. Trump, like Lincoln, came out of nowhere. Both men were outsiders. Yet from the outset, Lincoln showed a resolve in taking on the Democratic plantation that can provide a valuable lesson to Trump. Lincoln was portrayed by the Democrats and their allies, just as Trump is now, as being a grave threat to their fundamental liberties. Yet we may ask about Trump the same question that Lincoln asked about himself. Has Trump actually violated any of the basic constitutional rights of his opponents? Has he deprived them of their free speech or their right to assemble or vote? No, he has not. And yet they persist in trying to drive him from office for the same reason their Democratic forebears sought to bring Lincoln to his knees, because they cannot abide the result of a free election. We need to step back and take in the full scope of this. For all that we learn about America's two-party system, as a practical matter, one party has dominated politics for a generation or more. We cannot count the founding period because there were no parties in the modern sense then. But from the 1820s through 1860, the Democrats were the majority party. From 1865 through 1932, it was the Republicans. From 1932 to 1980, the Democrats became the dominant party once again. Political dominance does not mean you control the presidency, both parties in Congress, and the Supreme Court. We know, for example, that Eisenhower and Nixon were Republican presidents during the era of Democratic dominance. But they were pulled to the center by the Democratic tide. Neither Eisenhower nor Nixon sought to undo the New Deal, nor could they have done so had they wanted to. In a way, Eisenhower solidified the New Deal and Nixon parts of the Great Society by acquiescing to them. Since 1980, however, American politics has been a draw. Neither party has enjoyed real dominance. Reagan was president for two terms in the 80s, but he had mostly a Democratic Congress. Then Clinton was president for two terms in the 90s, but the GOP swept the Congress in 1994. George W. Bush and Barack Obama both initially had congressional majorities in both houses but couldn't hold them, forcing them to deal with rival party obstruction in their second term. Then in 2016, everything came up for grabs. The Democrats saw a chance to make their plantation permanent. If Hillary won the presidency and Democrats rode her coattails to make strong gains in the House and the Senate, Democrats would have not only the presidency and the Congress, but also the chance to lock the Supreme Court into a 6-3 Democratic majority. This would spell the beginning of the end for Republicans, sending them the way of the Whigs. Then the Democrats could open the gates to massive illegal immigration while at the same time granting amnesty to the illegals already here. By adding several million new voters to the rolls, mostly but not exclusively Latino, Democrats could expand their Latino plantation and also tip the balance of American votes, now precariously divided between the parties, decisively in their favor. This would give Democrats the kind of control that would last indefinitely into the future. We've seen it happen in California, which was once Nixon country and Reagan country. As James Q. Wilson argued decades ago in the essay Reagan Country, California once embodied the American dream of owning a piece of paradise with two cars in front and a pool in the backyard. But illegal immigration has changed the demographic composition of the state. the Republican Party is no longer competitive at the state level, and Democrats can safely count on Californians to vote for whomever they nominate in a presidential year. I moved to California in 2000. Much as I liked the sun, the palm trees, and the ocean, over time I saw what it means to live in a progressive one-party state. Eventually, I grew weary of the confiscatory taxation, the absurd regulations, the preposterous edicts making it illegal to report illegals, and granting children the right to decide their own gender. This, I realized, is progressive utopia, and I didn't want to subsidize it anymore. So Debbie and I moved to her home state of Texas. For progressive Democrats, however, California is the model, and their hope is that as California goes, so goes the nation. But the American people, speaking through the same relatively narrow electoral majority that elected Lincoln, decided otherwise. By electing Trump and preserving Republican majorities in the House and, much more narrowly, the Senate, Americans gave the GOP the dominance that Democrats aspired to. In his first few months, Trump saved the court by shepherding Neil Gorsuch's nomination to confirmation. One more appointee, and the court, which is now leaning GOP, will be out of Democratic hands. So this explains the dismay and horror of the Democrats at Trump's presence in the White House. For them, in the words of progressive critic Walter Kern, "The unimaginable has become the historical. Trump's election gave me the impression that time was warping. It was a trick of the gods to remind us cocky mortals that we are not in control of our affairs. It was a total eclipse, cutting a spooky swath of darkness across the Republic, giving Kern himself a sense of temporal displacement." This quasi-religious vocabulary gives you a sense of how big the stakes were for Kern and others like him. Then there is Trump's Olympian vigor, which must only add to the left's dismay. Not only is Trump in there, but he's a fighter, and he fights on both the political and cultural fronts. He's the most politically incorrect president in American history. And as the tax bill, the Gorsuch nomination, and progress on peace in Korea, and in the fight against ISIS showed, Trump has the ability to get things done. Having dismissed him as a buffoon and a moron, the progressive left is now deathly scared of him. The Wolf and the Lamb. The similarities between Lincoln's day and our own go far beyond the surface resemblance between the 1860 and 2016 elections. Today, too, we have a Democratic plantation, not just black this time, but populated with dependent and subjugated minority populations. Today as well, we have a befuddled Republican Party tempted to make peace with the plantation and in search of a leader who might have Lincoln's prescience and fortitude. Today, Republicans have a chance, as Lincoln did, to topple the Democratic plantation, perhaps this time even beyond the possibility of salvage and rehabilitation. Let's begin with the perversion of language, a problem as familiar in Lincoln's time as it is in our own. Then, as now, enslavement was justified by the Democrats through an appeal to obfuscation and deception. Lincoln did not hesitate to point this out. In an 1864 address at a Baltimore fair, Lincoln said, "We all declare for liberty, but in using the same word, we do not all mean the same thing. With some, the word liberty may mean for each man to do as he pleases with himself and the product of his labor, while with others the same word may mean for some men to do as they please with other men and the product of other men's labor." Continuing in his characteristic manner of being both homespun and deep, Lincoln added, "The shepherd drives the wolf from the sheep's throat, for which the sheep thanks the shepherd as a liberator, while the wolf denounces him for the same act as the destroyer of liberty. Plainly, the sheep and the wolf are not agreed upon a definition of the word liberty, and precisely the same difference prevails today among us human creatures, even in the North, and all professing to love liberty." Even in the North. Lincoln recognized that the Northern and Southern Democrats were in it together, and that the Democrats were the party of the wolf, invoking liberty for themselves, even as they suppressed and choked the liberty of others and stole the fruits of their labor. For all the vicissitudes of history, some things remain the same. Vulpine extortion and theft have defined the democratic plantation from the outset, and they continue to define the democratic plantation even now. This is not to say that the plantation in the 21st century is unchanged from what it was in the 19th. In a partial vindication of both Parmenides and Heraclitus, we see that history is an account of both continuities and discontinuities. In the movie The Godfather, the Corleone family moved its operations from New York to Las Vegas. Why? Because their opportunities in New York grew thin. Thus, they moved from labor rackets involving control of the unions and bootlegging to the more fertile territory of casino gambling. The move to Vegas showed creative improvisation, the ability to start afresh and build from the ground up, and yet the Corleones remained the Corleones. The crime family itself did not change, even when it changed location and tactics. Theft and extortion continued as the heart of the operation. In New York, it was camouflaged as the olive oil business. In Vegas, it was hidden behind the operation of casinos. In both places, however, the Corleones used their power to forcibly extract money from others. In some respect, the Democrats elect the Corleones. And just like that large and varied family, the Democrats over time have shown themselves to be a mixed bunch. Some are thoughtful, like Calhoun and Fitzhugh. Others are dull, like Pierce and Buchanan. Some are swashbuckling, like Van Buren, Boss Tweed, and LBJ. Others are drearily pedantic, like Woodrow Wilson and Obama. Some are straight-laced, like Tawney and Jimmy Carter. Others are con artists, like Andrew Jackson, FDR, and Bill and Hillary Clinton. What unites this political family through time, however, is the commitment of its leaders to the plantation in its various guises and phases. The old Democrats made a gallant attempt to make an open public defense of the slave plantation. Today's Democrats, however, recognize that their new urban plantations are indefensible. In this respect, we can liken the Democrats to today's neo-Nazis. The old Nazis were open about their anti-Semitism, and they attempted to justify their horrific treatment of Jews. Hitler repeatedly warned that the Jews deserved what was coming to them, and so on. But after the Holocaust, things changed. Today's neo-Nazis don't try to defend the Holocaust, they deny it even happened. In a similar vein, today's Democrats don't claim credit for the conditions of their urban plantations. Even though those places are one-party systems run exclusively by Democrats, they attempt to foist the blame for their unlivable conditions on white racism, on Republicans, on America in general, on anyone except the group that created those plantations and has governed them for over the half century from their formation to the present. Two big lies. The progressive account of American history, which is basically a narrative designed to cover up the plantation, is defined by two big lies. The first big lie is that fascism is a phenomenon of the right. The second is that racism is a defining characteristic of conservatives and of the Republican Party. Both lies work together to distort American history and to project the blame for democratic atrocities onto the very people who sought, with varying degrees of success, to stop them. In reality, as I've shown in this book, fascism is a phenomenon of the left, and racism is the defining characteristic of progressives and the Democratic Party. This is true not merely of the origins or the history of progressives and Democrats, it is also true of the ideology and practice of progressive Democrats today. So they are the real fascists. They are the real racists. Only when these big lies are fully exposed can we clearly see the plantation in full view and recognize who is responsible for it. We need to look closely because the democratic plantation is a kind of amoeba. It evolves over time. In this book, I have shown five distinct plantation phases, bringing us up to the present. The first phase was the old rural slave plantation, 1828 to 1860. Here, the democratic planter class became rich and lazy by directly stealing the labor and liberty of the slaves. The Democrats became prosperous by ripping off the poorest of the poor. We should not think of this as a purely private racket. the state played a role as well, through an elaborate structure of laws that upheld the plantation. The state also employed slave patrols to protect what it viewed as the property of the plantation. It was a good racket while it lasted, but unfortunately for the Democrats, it was ruined by Lincoln and the Republicans and finally came to an end at Appomattox in 1865. The second phase was Van Buren's Northern Urban Machine, 1836 to 1932, itself modified from the rural plantation. Here the Democrats figured out how to exploit not blacks, but ethnic immigrant populations, recognizing them to be as fearful, vulnerable, and insecure as the slaves. Democrats bought the votes of these groups through goodies appropriated from the city treasury. Essentially, they perverted the founders' constitutional scheme by turning politics into a crooked game of looting the taxpayer to fund an ethnically based patronage system of government employment and government handouts designed to keep the crooks perpetually in power. The third phase was the National Progressive Plantation, which we can also term the fascist plantation. I date this from 1932 to 1964. Here, Wilson in theory and FDR in practice converted the local and state ethnic machines of the 19th and early 20th centuries into a single machine. The federal government became the big house, controlling the private sector and increasingly the ordinary lives of citizens. FDR's plantation overseers were not city ward operatives, but rather labor union organizers and strongmen who drew on the muscle of the federal government to force into compliance employers and also fellow workers. While importing ideas from Mussolini's Italy and Hitler's Germany, FDR created in America a distinctive democratic brand of fascism, which is to say fascism that courted popular support in order to sustain FDR in office. Yet notwithstanding his appreciation for Mussolini, FDR's fascist plantation more closely resembled Nazism than Italian fascism in that it had a strongly racist component facilitating segregation, lynching, and racial terrorism against African Americans. The fourth phase was LBJ's plantation, which can be officially dated 1964 to 1980, although a good bit of it continues to the present day. LBJ realized that after World War II, racism had declined sharply, and therefore the Democratic Party could no longer count on the white racist vote, even in the South. The problem was that Americans were simply not racist enough. So in an historic turn, LBJ decided that Democrats thereafter should go after the black vote. He reconstituted FDR's plantation by, in effect, turning blacks from a group directly oppressed and exploited by the Democrats into a group only indirectly exploited because now they were an ethnic constituency, as, for example, the Irish had been in the past. Unlike the old plantation where slaves worked and produced things, LBJ's plantation was designed to produce nothing and prevent its inhabitants from working. Self-control was replaced by government control, and the idle, uneducated, irresponsible citizen became LBJ's model citizen. The big house now existed to take care of such people. LBJ's plantation was responsible for the cultural pathologies of the inner city, in some cases doing even more harm to the African-American community than had been done by earlier generations of Democrats through slavery. Slavery, for example, disabled, but did not permanently destroy the black family. Somehow LBJ's welfare state managed to do what even slavery could not do. Democrats, although rhetorically inconsolable about the plight of the black underclass, have no intention of changing it because they want to keep this population fully dependent on them. Finally, there is today's multicultural plantation, which includes LBJ's plantation, but can more accurately be termed Obama's plantation. Thus, we can date it from the 1980s through today. Notice that Obama himself did very little for blacks. He rarely visited the inner city. He did nothing to address the issues of crime, gangs, or broken families. All he did was to expand welfare benefits and food stamps. Clearly, blacks are a group that Democrats now take for granted. Even America's first African-American president didn't feel the need to address their plight other than to keep the benefits flowing to ensure their total dependency on the Democratic Party. Obama's remaking of America seems to have focused more on what may be termed the frontier of the Democratic plantation. Obama fought hard to legalize and normalize gay marriage, and he introduced the DACA policy of refusing to deport the children of illegal immigrants who have grown up in the United States. In this respect, Obama may be considered a plantation recruiter, seeking to draw new groups, homosexual activists and illegals, to join blacks in relying on the federal government for their security and advancement. Obama, like Bill Clinton, was part of the project to expand the Democratic plantation beyond blacks, to include Latino barrios and Native American reservations. Each group was recruited into a project of delivering votes as part of an ethnic collective, in exchange for which each group was maintained in a state of stupefied subjugation. So powerful was this parasitism that groups became dependent and servile, and despite their miseries, constantly voted to sustain in power the party that was subjugating them. Even Asian Americans would have enclaves if the Democrats could figure out how to lock them into ethnic Chinatowns and Koreatowns. Of all minorities, Democrats have had the least success with this group. The Asian American plantation seems to have only overseers, very few inhabitants. Democrats, however, are hoping to change that. As an Asian American myself, I can only wish them failure with this exploitative project. Plantation control. Only whites, even whites undergoing economic hardship and plagued by cultural dysfunction, have so far resisted succumbing to the lure of the Democratic plantation. What makes this hard for Democrats to take is that whites used to be on the plantation, both the poor whites of the South and the ethnic whites who were once part of the northern urban machines. Van Buren had them, Wilson had them, FDR had them, but now the Democrats have lost them. What happened? The problem is that whites assimilated. The Irish became Americans and ceased to think of themselves as Irish. They were once Irish Americans, now they are Americans of Irish descent. One may say that ethnic identity became an American identity. The affirmation of American identity is one of the hallmarks of the Republican Party. Thus, when the immigrants assimilated, the Democrats lost them as a group to the GOP. This is the main reason why Democrats don't want Latinos to learn English and assimilate, because that may mean Latinos would follow the example of the Irish and escape the political captivity of the Democratic Party. Plantation control is a very serious business. These are terrible places that no one is supposed to leave or even want to leave. The happiest people on the plantation are the overseers, who siphon off large amounts of money reserved for the poor and the destitute, while also enjoying their task of lording it over the plantation's hapless inhabitants. Conscious of this, the Democrats have anointed a vast, multicultural overseer class to patrol their new ethnic plantations. One of the main tasks of the overseers is to ensure that few people depart the plantation. The overseers do this not merely through working to establish the complete dependency of their subject populations. They also do it by vilifying anyone, especially blacks or other minorities, who seek to criticize or reform the Democratic plantation. In the mode of Du Bois vilifying Booker T. Washington, today's overseer class bashes black and Hispanic conservatives and independents, accusing them of being accessories to minority oppression. What makes these accusations downright insane is that the Democratic plantation is the greatest force for oppression and racist subjugation in American history. Nowhere is racist exploitation today more obvious than on the Democrats' multicultural plantations. Even so, we have the strange phenomenon of plantation administrators and accessories, the real Uncle Toms, accusing free-thinking and freedom-loving minorities of being Uncle Toms. The vehemence of these accusations shows how much the Democratic plantation class has always hated runaways. The only prospect scarier for a Democrat than a plantation runaway is the dismantling of the plantation system itself. The Democrats currently have no intention of dismantling it. The only way they would consider that would be if the plantation ceased to pay off politically for them. In that case, they might give it up. But that would spell the end of the Democratic Party as it is now constituted. The Democrats in that case would have to go straight, or what seems more likely, given the party's history, find themselves a new scam. A glorious history There is only one group that can shut down the plantation, Trump and the Republican Party. Both have a direct stake in doing this because the plantation is antithetical to what Trump believes and to what Republicans have stood for and stand for today. While many Republicans have no idea how to defeat the plantation, some are in fact wasting their energies fighting against Trump, they can and must learn. Only Trump and the GOP together can save American nationalism and avert the death of the nation. To a degree never recognized, Lincoln and the Republicans are the founders of modern American nationalism. Wait a minute, you say, shouldn't we credit the American founders for that? Not really. It is true, as Samuel Huntington writes, that only in the founding era did the British settlers on the Atlantic coast begin to identify themselves not only as residents of their individual colonies, but also as Americans. Ben Franklin, who called himself a Briton prior to 1776, began to consider himself an American following the Revolution. Even so, Huntington recognizes, it was not until the conclusion of the Civil War that America's identity as a single nation was securely established. Prior to the Civil War, we were the United States plural. Only after Appomattox did we become the United States singular. Since the Civil War, Huntington writes, Americans have been a flag-oriented people. The Stars and Stripes has the status of a religious icon and is a more central symbol of national identity for Americans than their flags are for people of other nations. Memorial Day was also commemorated for the first time following the Civil War. Today's progressive Democrats, just like their Democratic forebears, loathe American nationalism because it advances a unifying vision that poses a mortal threat to their politics of ethnic mobilization and to the Democratic plantation itself. I never used the word nation in speaking of the United States, John C. Calhoun declared in 1849. We are not a nation, but a confederacy of equal and sovereign states. If Calhoun reviled American nationalism in the name of states' rights, today's Democrats do so in the name of internationalism or ethnic diversity. Progressive philosopher Martha Nussbaum denounces patriotic pride as morally dangerous and urges Americans to give their allegiance to the worldwide community of human beings. Political scientist Amy Gutman insists it is repugnant for Americans to regard themselves above all as citizens of the United States. And invoking the ethnic diversity in this country, Elizabeth Brunig recently wrote in the Washington Post that nationalism is a chimera because the American nation itself is a chimera. Such a thing does not exist. The Republican Party is well equipped to fight the plantation because it has a glorious history of fighting against racism and white supremacy. This is hardly known even in the precincts of the GOP. Here we can identify the great battles fought by the GOP. First, Republicans mobilized the armies of the North to defeat the combined efforts, military and political, of the Democratic Party to save slavery and make it permanent. Second, Republicans shut down the Ku Klux Klan for a period and fought vigorously, though not successfully, to curb Democratic efforts to promote segregation and racial terrorism. Third, Republicans spearheaded the Civil Rights Revolution of the 1860s, the revolution that produced the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, as well as Reconstruction, the first attempt to build a multiracial democracy in America, which was sadly thwarted by the Democrats. Fourth, a century later, Republicans were indispensable to the passage of the Civil Rights laws, including the Civil Rights Act of 1964, that made those original Republican amendments a practical reality. Republicans are also the original formulators of the doctrine of color blindness that is often credited to Martin Luther King. When King said he dreamt of living in a nation where we are judged by the content of our character, not the color of our skin, he was echoing the GOP ideal first enunciated 100 years earlier by Frederick Douglass. King deserves appreciation, of course, for reaffirming the principle, but he should have given credit to Douglass for coming up with it. Progressives privately loathe Douglass, and in public they dishonor him by ignoring him. Douglass, not King, is America's greatest black leader. I suspect King would have acknowledged this. Yet progressives fawn over King while spurning Douglass. This silent treatment is not merely because Douglass was a Republican. It is also because Douglass, speaking to the Massachusetts Anti-Slavery Society just days before the Civil War ended, uttered what is, from the progressive point of view, the ultimate heresy. Douglass raised the question, what must be done for the former slaves? He answered, do nothing with us. Your doing with us has already played the mischief with us. Do nothing with us. If the Negro cannot stand on his own legs, let him fall. All I ask is give him a chance to stand on his own legs also. Let him alone. If you will only untie his hands and give him a chance, I think he will live. Ouch! What could be a starker repudiation of the Democratic plantation? Douglass can be heard speaking across the span of time to that conniving bigot LBJ, telling the corrupt old Democrat that he sees right through him and wants none of his condescending patronage. Progressive Democrats can forgive Douglass his tirades against the old slave plantation, at least publicly, that is their position also, but they cannot forgive the scorn he presciently heaped on their current one. Party of Lincoln. Douglass embodied who the Republicans are, the party of individual rights and upward striving, and what Douglass himself called the self-made man. These were also, as we have seen, Lincoln's ideals. Today, there are many Republicans who blame Trump for the de-Reaganization of the Republican Party and wistfully pine for the 1980s era of gentleman's politics. This is, by and large, the main source of anxiety about Trump in some Republican quarters, and it is also the driving momentum of the so-called Never Trump movement. I came of age in the Reagan era, and I too prefer a more civil political climate, but that is not the America we live in now. Reagan's policies and style were calibrated to deal with the specific problems and specific political environment of the late 1970s. Today, however, a good deal of Reaganism is dated. Not only has stagflation, that toxic combination of slow growth combined with runaway inflation, disappeared and the Soviet Union collapsed, but Reagan himself would be a fish out of water in the dark, roiled currents of today. But Lincoln wouldn't. His political environment was even more roiled than the one we have now, and Lincoln would have seen that in this environment, an environment made by a gangster clan of Democrats like Obama and Hillary, you don't get very far with Reagan's courtly style. In short, Trump is the man of the hour, not Reagan. Trump has the chance to do what even Reagan never dreamed about, taking a page from Lincoln and smashing the Democratic plantation. When we consider Trump's two big Republican heresies, his positions on trade and immigration, we can see that they might be heresies from Reagan's point of view, but they were not heresies from Lincoln's point of view. As Gaber Borit shows in Lincoln and the Economics of the American Dream, Lincoln's GOP was unabashedly protectionist and viewed tariffs as a necessary and valid economic strategy to protect American workers and American industry from mercantilist competition from European powers. And while many progressives as well as conservatives insist that tariffs have never worked, Borit shows that America had tariffs from Hamilton's time through the end of the 19th century, and it was during this period that America grew most rapidly and became the largest economy in the world, surpassing Great Britain. On immigration, too, Trump and Lincoln can be seen as generally aligned. This point is hardly obvious, but we get a vital clue about how Lincoln would have thought about today's immigration debate by considering the position Lincoln actually took on extending civil rights, the right to full citizenship, the right to vote, the right to serve on juries, to blacks. Lincoln basically held that it was wrong for any people anywhere to enslave another people because slavery was wrong, or to put it philosophically, against natural right. But natural rights are not the same as civil rights. Civil rights are the product of living in a particular community. The community is a social compact between the citizens who have formed that community. These existing citizens have the right to decide who gets to be a member of their club and on what terms. For this reason, Lincoln insisted that opposition to slavery and the extension of civil protections to blacks were two separate issues. Before the war, Lincoln was committed to fighting only for the former. Only after the war did he move tentatively in the direction of the latter. It follows from this that Lincoln would have agreed with Trump that the interests of natives, must be considered prior to those of potential new immigrants, and that natives are the ones who get to decide who is allowed to immigrate and in what number and on what conditions. This, by the way, applies to decisions about legal and illegal immigration. But hold it, the progressive will say, America is a nation of immigrants. Immigrants are the ones who made America. Actually, this is only a partial truth. As the founders and Lincoln all recognized, the first Americans were not immigrants. They were settlers. There's a difference. Immigrants are people who come individually, in families or in small groups, to a country that has already been created and established. Immigrants, one might say, are people who apply to be members of a club whose rules appeal to them. Settlers, however, are the original group that forms that community in the first place and charts out its basic rules or constitution. This settler label would apply both to the Pilgrims and the American founders. Trump somehow knows all this, either through learning or just intuitively. And ironically, Trump, in adopting the policies of Lincoln rather than those of Reagan, is proving that he is the first Republican since Reagan to win the support of the group once known as the Reagan Democrats. Since Reagan, the GOP has unsuccessfully wooed these voters by anodyne appeals to abortion and other social issues. Trump is the first one to appeal to them both on economic and social issues, and that is why the descendants of the Reagan Democrats now have a new name, Trumpsters. Trump is the only Republican on the scene today who actually has the chance to launch the final defeat of the Democratic plantation. Trump can realize Lincoln's goal of a country that lifts artificial weights from all shoulders and affords its citizens an unfettered start in the race of life. To do this, he must re-Lincolnize the GOP. First, this means going further than opposing racial preferences and affirmative action. He must eliminate racial categories from the census and promote a new Civil Rights Act that outlaws using those categories to discriminate against any ethnic group, black, white, brown, or yellow. Republicans have been talking color blindness for a long time. It's time to implement it. Second, Trump must invade the Democratic plantation with creative policies that restore entrepreneurship, jobs, and opportunity to America's barrios, ghettos, and Native American reservations. Surely there are blacks, Latinos, and Native Americans in these communities who would welcome a chance to learn, to improve themselves, and to prosper there. Trump and the GOP can help this process through a bold combination of tax incentives, deregulation, and arm twisting of the kind that Trump specializes in, as well as the suspension of destructive family and social policies that encourage illegitimacy, crime, and civic breakdown. The GOP already has the formula. What's needed now are the spine and the nerve to put it into effect. It won't be easy. Trump needs the Republicans behind him on this because the Democrats, who are already in a fevered mode, are going to go berserk. We are likely to see a Democratic uproar echo through the halls of Congress, reverberate through the media, cause fainting spells in Hollywood, and crack the tectonic plates of the culture. Trump and the Republicans, united, calm, and collected, should show the same resolve that Lincoln set in effect to the Democratic planters of his time. Bring it on. To be clear, the long-term goal for Trump and the GOP is not merely to improve life on the plantation. The goal, rather, is its shutdown, the panic-filled dispersion of the overseers, in short, total emancipation. Once these hellholes are permanently transformed, no longer will America be plagued by the wretched politics of white supremacy and ethnic exploitation. Whites, blacks, and browns can all dream the American dream and pursue happiness, not so much as whites, blacks, Latinos, or whatever, but rather as individuals, as families, and as Americans. Finally, we need the cleansing antidote of truth. Democrats today are not content with promoting lies. They are insistent that we collaborate and bow to their lies. This is not a new demand. The question recurs, Lincoln said, of the Democrats in his Cooper Union speech in February 1860. What will satisfy them? And Lincoln answered, this and only this, cease to call slavery wrong and join them in calling it right. Silence will not be tolerated. We must place ourselves avowedly with them. The enforcement of political correctness has been a Democratic strategy from Lincoln's day to our own. For too long, conservatives and Republicans have allowed big lies to take over the culture and, in some cases, their minds. This progressive cultural hegemony has polluted our education system and our media with fake narratives and fake history. It has also created a kind of Stockholm syndrome among conservative intellectuals. In our hearts, we know we're wrong. But we're not wrong. We've been lied to. It's time for us to stop apologizing. We have nothing to apologize for and go on the offensive. Truth is our deadliest weapon if we will deploy it. The defeat of the plantation would make Trump the first great president of the 21st century and the GOP the worthy custodian of American ideals. With our support, Trump can bring to an end the vicious strain of exploitation that the Democratic Party has wrought for nearly 200 years. What better way to rescue the principles of the founders and to vindicate the philosophical statesmanship of Lincoln than to sweep away this blight on the American experiment, this nightmarish interruption of the American dream? The fiery trial through which we pass, Lincoln said in his annual message to Congress in 1862, will light us down in honor or dishonor to the latest generation. The point, he had already stated in his Peoria speech several years earlier, was not merely to save the Union. Rather, if we do this, we shall not only have saved the Union, but we shall have so saved it as to make and to keep it forever worthy of the saving. This America worth saving is the object of our striving. It is what Lincoln termed the last best hope on earth.
We hope you've enjoyed Death of a Nation, a Macmillan audiobook production from All Points Books, an imprint of St. Martin's Press. Text copyright 2018 by Dinesh D'Souza. Production copyright 2018 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.